If you have ever struggled with masculinity or shame issues, you'll want to give this episode a listen. My guest, Travis Stock, shares his struggle with all of the early messages he received about masculinity and how much shame was associated with his own masculinity. He relates how all the coping mechanisms that he created as a child that were put in place to keep him safe were the same coping mechanisms that held him back as an adult. He unpacks his journey of dismantling these coping mechanisms in his quest to become his fully authentic self. He shares how learning to love himself played such a powerful role in this process. Travis is a coach, facilitator, teacher, and host of the New Masculine podcast. You can access a link to the podcast in the show notes. Travis Stock, welcome to the Authentic Gay Man podcast. I am so glad you're here and thrilled to have you as my guest.
Thanks for having me. It's a real pleasure to be here.
Well, thank you. Let me tell the audience that we have known each other for maybe a couple of weeks, I'm thinking.
New friends.
And it was really random how we met. I posted something in a Facebook group that Travis is a member of, and he liked it. And it only got one like. And so it got my attention, you know, and I clicked through to see who he was and then discovered that he was a podcaster himself. And so I thought, oh, I need to meet him. So I reached out and we had a pretty lengthy one-on-one Zoom where we got acquainted and talked about our lives and our businesses. And then we decided that we would collaborate. So here he is being a guest. And at some point I'm scheduled to be a guest on his podcast. So it's just amazing what happens when you just click on that one little like.
I love a little cross-pollination. Yeah, I've been a part of that Facebook group for a long time and I'm not active at all. I don't even necessarily pay attention that often. And for some reason, a notification came in from your post. And I, as a fellow podcaster, wanted to celebrate that and be honoring of another gay man that's really focused on helping us deepening our relationship to ourselves and authenticity and thoughtfulness. And so it's just a quick like to kind of send you some good energy. And I'm so glad you were brave enough to jump out and connect on a deeper level.
Oh, thank you very much. See, you didn't tell me that in our first conversation. So it's really great to hear that story. I love that. I thought, take a risk. You never know where this is going to go. And so, yeah, I did. So a little bit about Travis. Travis is a coach. He's a facilitator, a teacher, and the name of his podcast is The New Masculine. And you can find a link to that in the show notes. And with that, let's start off with my first question, Travis. What does it mean to you to be an authentic gay man?
It's a good question. I think I would say that my definition probably has evolved over time around what that means to me. I think initially I probably would have said that being authentic gay man had something to do with being wholly myself without fear, claiming to the world who I am at all times. And I think that was an important part of my claiming of my identity as a gay man when I was initially coming out, after spending many years trying not to be a gay man and trying to hide that. I think claiming it and saying this is my identity and living fearlessly was, trying to live fearlessly at least, was sort of the goal of my authenticity at that point. I think it's become more nuanced to me at this point. I think there is a broader acceptance for myself around my own vulnerability, around my own fears, around my own safety, around my own sense of belonging and community. And so I think how I would kind of define it now would be to say that I'm an authentic gay man when I am deeply aware of my own wants, needs, and desires, and feeling safe enough to be able to communicate that to others. But then there's also this element of being within a community of people that I've gathered around me that I do trust, that I do feel safety around, and that I'm aware of their wants and needs and desires, and that we're sort of back and forth being able to show up for each other. I think that feels like authenticity to me, and it feels like my willingness to show up as an authentic gay man in the world has a lot to do with my willingness to show up with all of me. And even if that sometimes is a vulnerable, scared part of myself that doesn't want to shout from the rooftops every single moment that I'm a big gay man or that I'm constantly trying to claim that identity as a way of proving something to myself.
Wow, that's an amazing answer. I love that. I love the way you went from the bold to the more subtle, the nuanced, as you called it. And I think that what you're describing in those early stages is probably a rite of passage for most of us. You know, and then I can remember a time when, you know, I had to announce to every new person right up front, by the way, I'm gay,
yeah.
You know, and then that faded away over a period of time. I don't ever feel the need to announce that now. And I would notice when having conversation with somebody new or a stranger, they would say, oh, you know, my boyfriend or my girlfriend does this. And I would say, oh, yeah, my boyfriend does the same thing, you know, and it wasn't an announcement. It was just a responding in like kind, and yet it let them know who and where I was. It has, I agree with you, become much more nuanced and subtle.
Yeah, I would say that it's probably very developmentally appropriate at certain phases of our lives to claim identities in that way and to say, this is who I am, especially identities that have been painful or have been shameful or that you've struggled with at different points in your life. As we claim them, we get to integrate them on a new level. And then at a certain point, that kind of claiming becomes inauthentic. It becomes forced in some way. It becomes part of the coping strategy or part of the dealing with the discomfort that comes with that identity. And so for me, as I got more comfortable with myself and as I became more just sort of integrated as a human being around my sexuality, it no longer needed to be the thing that I was pushing out in front of me. It could just be a part of me.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Well, I want to call out to the listeners that Travis did not know I was going to ask him that question. So kudos for, you know, you're the second person that after you shared your thoughts about what it means to be an authentic gay man that I said, wow, mic drop, you know, that was like, and I've gotten some really, really good answers, but there's been a couple that have really stood out. And this is certainly one of them. Like, If the listeners didn't know, they would think you pre-thought, knew what this was, and you completely mapped it all out. And that's not the case. He just shot that from the hip. So that's pretty impressive.
Well, thank you. I mean, the title of your podcast kind of gives it away of like what to be thinking about. So I can't say that I didn't put any thought into it, but you're right. I didn't know you were going to ask that question.
I love it.
I absolutely love it. That is too funny. Well, now the real question. What in your life has been the biggest challenge or continues to be the biggest challenge that you are still working through?
I think for me, I internalized a fair amount of shame growing up. And oddly enough, I'll put a caveat on that. I didn't grow up in a family that was shaming me for being gay, or I actually grew up in a reconciling congregation of the United Methodist Church, which was performing gay and lesbian commitment ceremonies while I was growing up in that church. And so it wasn't like I had some really awful, horrible story of families that were shaming me, but I came into the world as a pretty sensitive little boy. Still am a sensitive little boy in many ways. And I internalized messages that were around me in the media and in broader conversations around the rights that we as gay men deserve, or as gay people, or as queer people, now is sort of one of the languagings we use around our community. And so I internalized this flaw about myself. And I remember witnessing on the kindergarten playground that other boys were interacting with me differently than they were interacting with others. Now, we didn't have language for that at the time, but I could notice that I was being noticed, and that scared me. I could notice that I was being seen as different, and that scared me. And then I spent a lot of my childhood really trying to avoid that difference. And sometimes that came out in sort of my emotional sensitivity. I still am a very emotionally sensitive person. And so vulnerability and tears and crying were something that were easily accessible to me. And yet I very clearly saw around me that boys weren't supposed to be doing that and men didn't do that. And so there was a lot of suppressing parts of myself as a way of trying to stay safe. I'm grateful for that little boy that figured out some coping strategies for the places that he didn't feel safe within. But it's been my life work to sort of go in and undo some of those coping strategies and those ways of staying safe in the world that served me back then, but have become quite limiting and have become quite restrictive in how they allow me to move through the world.
Well, your story is, I'm really resonating with me, Travis. I experienced so much of what you're describing, the playground. I knew that I was different at an early age, and so did they. Mm-hmm. And I don't think I did very well with the coping mechanisms. I wasn't good at making anybody believe that I was like them or not the way that I was. And I too was a very sensitive and still am a very sensitive and emotional little boy. I literally cry multiple times a week, you know, and I've drawn friendships to me that, you know, are the same way. One of my friends came over for dinner last night and sat at my table and just cried. He's going through a lot of transitions. He had all this fabulous stuff going on in his life, but it's so much transition. I mean, and I do mean it's all fabulous stuff, but there's just so much transition. And he was on overload and he cried, you know. And there's just something about that certainly is a big part of authenticity and vulnerability is our ability to really feel our emotions and express our emotions. And I'm very drawn to men who can do that. I will say I'm a sucker for a man that can cry. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean on any romantic or sexual level. I'm just a sucker for any man that can cry. It just draws me in like a moth to flame.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've gotten to that place too, where I used to reject that part of myself. And so then I would reject it in others. But as I've done the work of accepting and belonging within myself, that has become something that I value and need to see in the men in my life, the men that I draw in close, that kind of vulnerability, that willingness to go there is something that I find really attractive. And is a part of the men that I allow into my inner circle is that the men that are willing to take that risk to break the rules of the man box and actually show up as a real human being. I think for so long, I was very interested in fitting in and belonging and looking very similar to the way other people do. Not, I don't mean physically, but just appearing to be very similar to whoever I sort of acknowledged was successful or popular or doing well in life. And that required me to reject lots of pieces of myself. And so the more and more I do that sort of belonging work with myself and acceptance of myself, the more and more I have space to find the other kinds of men, like you're saying, that are willing to go there, that are willing to show that vulnerability and to cry. So it's definitely something I'm attracted to at this point in my life too.
Yes. And you so beautifully articulated, you know, I frequently say fitting in and belonging are two very different things. And in order to fit in, we have to literally carve parts of ourselves away, you know, just like you'd have to carve part of the square peg away to get it into the round hole. And you just very clearly articulated that in that you had to deny pieces of who you were in order to fit in. Whereas belonging is about showing up fully authentic and people accepting you and honoring you just exactly the way you are naturally behind the masks.
Yeah. I mean, that's a conversation that I'm having on the podcast that I host around masculinity. In some ways, one of the sort of belief systems that I have at this current stage of observing in conversations and development as a man is that there are a lot of ways that the socialization that we go through as boys, as we become men, is inherently asking us to divorce ourselves of who we really are so that we can become this ideal version of a man. We can't be emotionally aware. We don't pay attention to our impact on others. We are not able to express caring and vulnerable emotions to others. There are places that our socialization really teach us that, oh, only boys play with this, only girls play with this. Man up, be stronger, don't cry. There's ways that we socialize boys into manhood that is inherently in some ways traumatic, because it asks us to leave parts of ourselves behind in order to be successful as a man. And for some of us, especially those of us that like kind of dive into coaching work or introspection or any level of therapy, we start to recognize that our life's work becomes about finding who we actually are versus who we learn to be in the world, to be successful, to belong, to receive love. And so I think that's sort of my life's mission, is to continue finding what are those coping strategies that I developed to navigate the world, and what's actually who I came into this world as. What are my real values versus what are my adopted values or acquired values?
Yes. You know, I do, because we come into the world fully authentic. We are born fully authentic, and it's all those messages that we get that separate us from who we really are. Mm-hmm. And some people never ever make it back. Mm-hmm. So if we're on the path to reconnecting with something that's deep inside of us, our true authenticity, we're ahead of the game. I would love to hear more, and I think that it would be of value to our listeners to hear more about those coping mechanisms that you're speaking about, what they look like and how they worked, and then how there was a point where you realized, although they had their value and their place at one point in your life, there was a point where they stopped working and became detrimental, I'm assuming. Mm-hmm. I know that's what I've experienced in my life. Yes, please. I will just, let you go with that. I want to hear all of it, please.
Yeah, I think the biggest one that comes to mind of my coping strategies was, in some ways, as a kid growing up, I noticed the way that men held power and anger, and the way that they used it to dominate, or they used it power over another person. And that didn't really sit with me very well. I didn't like that. I didn't like feeling that way. In some ways, I already felt like in sort of like that. In many masculine kind of conversations, we're talking about who's the alpha male and who's the beta male. Like, in some ways, I already came into the world feeling like a beta male or less of a man because I was gay. And so that sort of power over dynamic just kept reinforcing that I was less powerful and was vulnerable, and other men were better than I was. And so in some ways, I learned to cut myself off from a lot of emotional expression while I was also pulling back the crying and the vulnerable part of myself, because that didn't feel safe. I also decided at one point I was never going to be one of those men that used my anger over someone. And arguably, I think that's a good value system to have. And yet that coping strategy created in the mind of a child whose brain isn't fully developed, that doesn't really understand abstract thought, it was a little black and white. And so what happened was I sort of cut myself off from my own anger, this divine emotion that exists within all of us that we all experience at different times in our life. And the consequences of that, it felt that energy has to go somewhere. And so for me, that anger, I felt safer if I just funneled it into sadness and kind of victimhood. And I realized at a certain point that most of my 20s, I was spending pretty depressed, pretty melancholy, pretty unaware of my own needs, pretty in pretty codependent patterns with other people of trying to make sure that I earned my value with people by making sure their needs were met without necessarily knowing what mine were. And so my coping strategy of funneling my anger energy into sadness and depression ended up being really harmful to me. And I would say, as I was sort of saying, the biggest thing I've had to overcome in my life is, or that I worked through, is that shame element. I'd argue that the shame, that internalizing of my anger was just a form of shame, was just that anger turned inwards. Instead of lashing out at other people, I just kept using it as a weapon against myself to control and get rigid and try to be perfect and try to be what everybody else needed so that I could be safe. And so it cut me off from my own clarity of who I was, what I wanted, what my real values were. And it took a lot of effort to like kind of observe that, see that, and know that something had to shift and something had to give in order for me to be able to actually fully express as an authentic human being in the world.
You're validating something right now that I've heard for quite some time now from the spiritual community, and that is depression is anger turned inwards. Anger that has been internalized, and you just spoke of that and then how it played a role as well in the shame.
At least for me, it was. Yeah, I don't know that everybody's depression happens to fall into that. I think there are some sort of chemical versions of depression, and there are different versions of it. But mine for sure was I had divorced myself from sort of the fiery energy that anger has to it, that empowered feeling that anger gives us. And I spent more time sitting in the victim. Why is this happening to me? Nobody gets me. Nobody wants to be with me. Nobody likes me. I don't belong. Why can't anybody see me? A lot of those kinds of, that kind of energy. And so, yeah, for me, the biggest thing that helped me move out of depression, once I realized that I was stuck there for a long time, was building a relationship to my own anger.
Mm, powerful.
And learning to actually utilize it as a constructive force rather than a destructive force.
And what did that look like?
It actually looked like me sitting. So something that I've taken part of in my life is I've done some level of plant medicine, psychedelic experience work with a facilitator in order to do some of my own transformation and healing work. And I was in a ceremony and guided by a facilitator. And I really got in touch with my anger. I got in touch with the feelings that I had around the places I had been wronged, the places where I didn't even know what my own needs were, how much space everybody else was taking up and how little space I was taking up. I got in touch with that anger in a really embodied sense. It felt like, in some ways, the image that came to my mind was sort of the way that a lion kind of moves and is empowered running on a plain in Africa. And this ability to claim space and to take up power, that didn't mean I had to use it over somebody, but that just that sort of inherent knowing of self and belonging to self that was empowering.
I wish the listeners could see what you're doing right now. I mean, guys, we're on video and I'm watching him move like a lion. It's pretty incredible. Like your energy shifted just as you started to tell the story.
Yeah. And oddly enough, nobody else can see it because they don't have the video either. But behind me on my shelf behind me is a lion's mask that a friend carved for me as a totem of that moment. That is sort of a remembering of why I need my anger. Why is it important to me? I don't have to leave it behind just because I've seen it inartfully used by others. I can learn to have my own relationship and to utilize it in a way that's aligned with my value system. It's not so black and white. It's more nuanced than that. It's a little bit more in flow with it. And it's still my work. Like I can't say that it's always, that I'm always the best at with anger expression in others or in my own anger. I can create a lot of space for it as a coach with my clients, but in my own personal life, I still have to navigate it. Sometimes I still have remnants of those places where it didn't feel safe to me as a kid. And sometimes it still doesn't feel safe to me now, but I have that totem behind me that helps me remember that there is a divine element to it that transformed my life out of victim and depression mode into a more empowered and, authentic man in the world, authentic gay man in the world.
This is just incredible. So tell me what that looked like.
Which part? There's so much to it.
That channeling that anger in a healthier and more meaningful way. What did that look like?
It looked like taking up more space. It looked like knowing where I begin and where others end. Like, so in some of my typical coping strategies were a lot of sort of more enmeshed patterns to be blended with somebody for the boundary to be less clear between me and someone else. And so do the work to clarify what that boundary is, to make it a little bit more clear of here's where I begin and end, and here's where you begin and end. And here's where we collaborate. Here's where the Venn diagram crosses over, but here are these separate circles that you belong in and that I belong in. And learning how to do that, learning to get clear on what my needs were, and then to be able to express them in relationships, to notice myself when I would get into those servicing and taking care of other people's needs, and actually checking in first, is there a need that's unmet within me? Resolving that, and then seeing whether or not I want to provide that act of service. Active service is one of my love languages. And so it can be a little tricky sometimes because it's how I love to express love to other people, but it can also come from a very shadow side, an unconscious side that's actually about me coping with something I'm not aware of yet. And so for me, it's been slowing it down enough to check in. What's the need that I haven't met in myself or that I haven't asked for from my community? And then I can engage in that act of service. So it's really about some healthy boundaries with myself, but healthy boundaries in my relationships too.
Yes. Yes. Service to others is an absolutely beautiful thing, but it too can have a shadow side where we avoid dealing with our own stuff by over servicing others.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so another element to this that I really loved was that I learned during that process that someone shared with me is that if you step up, like if you watch the emotional ladder of where anger comes from and where it leads to, like if you step up the emotional scale, you go maybe from rage to anger, anger to frustration, frustration to passion, maybe. Once I saw that it could be a constructive force, that it could fuel me into certain things, it transformed my ability to be with that emotion. So for example, the podcast that I host, The New Masculine, is just as much about the change I want to see out there in the world as it is about my own healing journey. The New Masculine is all about disrupting outdated models of masculinity in service of new ways forward for men. As a gay man, I don't know that I've always felt welcome to the conversation around what makes a man, what is masculine, what does masculinity mean?
I'm raising my hand right now.
Yeah. And so for me, my anger about being cast out of that conversation or not welcomed in that space actually fueled a sense of passion to say, I'm going to claim some space. I'm going to take a seat at this table, whether I've been welcomed or not, because I do think I have something to offer to this. It became the fuel that drives my sense of passion to engage in the work that I'm really most hopeful to be a part of and wanted the change I most want to see in the world. And so once I recognize that my anger was actually the birthplace, could be the birthplace of fuel and source for how I show up to improve the world, then I was like, oh, okay, there is divine element to this. There is something that's important so that I can create spaces where we all get to benefit from power rather than the old systems, which says I have power and you don't have power. We take from each other, those scarcity models around power. Yes. I'm trying to create spaces where we have power with each other.
I love that, Travis. I love that. And I, you know, I, that being invited to the table about the masculinity piece, I think I had an awareness at one point that it wasn't that I wasn't invited or welcome to the table. It was that I wasn't allowing myself to sit at the table. I had determined that I didn't deserve to sit at that table. It was never that I felt like nobody wanted me at that table. It was more about the way what I did with it internally.
Mm-hmm.
Like I didn't belong at that table. I wasn't a masculine man, so I didn't belong at that table. It was me that cut me out of that, not somebody else.
I think that's true. And I also think we internalize societal messages over and over and over again, that there is a certain way to be a man. And if you don't fit into that, then you don't have a seat at the table. And so, yes, I think a lot of that, that's what I had to give myself permission to step into that conversation. I was needed to not hold myself back. But the reality is some of the early feedback I got was, what does this fag have to tell me about being a man? And so it's like, there are those societal messages that are telling us that we are less of a man because of X, Y, Z. But that's why one of the values that I have with the work that I'm doing is to bring to the table voices that aren't heard, men of color, trans men, people who identify as non-binary, but have a deep relationship to the masculine, is to continue including more and more voices so that it's not just cisgender, heterosexual, white, Christian men who are deciding what manliness is or what masculinity is or what's acceptable ways for us to show up as men.
You know, and I'd be willing to bet that if you ask a cross-section of straight women, especially those that know gay men, that have been around gay men and have gay friends, they would tell you that some of their gay friends are more men than their straight male friends.
Yeah, what's more masculine than somebody that's had to break the rules of what their society told them to do, to go as counterculture as what we as gay men have to do in order to show up and be authentic in the world?
Thank you. You know, it takes to go against the norm. People say, oh, but that's weakness. Vulnerability is weakness. No, are you kidding me? It takes a shitload of courage and strength to go swim against the stream and do what is deemed unacceptable. You said that beautifully. I love it.
Choosing to listen to your own voice versus listening to what others say is acceptable and what's okay. To me, that's very brave. That's very courageous and is not necessarily what I would say is only available to men, but in terms of masculine and feminine energies, it's pretty masculine to have such a singular focus on, I know what my path is, I know what authenticity is, I know what my values are, and here's how I'm going to show up in the world. It's a pretty masculine approach.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. It's taken me a long time to figure that out. You know, I got those messages early on. You know, we didn't use the word gay when I was growing up. You were a sissy. And I got called sissy until I internalized that. And I have always felt much more in alignment and connected to the feminine energy than I have been the masculine energy. It's only been in the last couple of years that I have really begun to, what I would call, integrate the two, which has been an incredible experience as I move into that. It's brought a sense of peace that I didn't have prior to that. I don't think we realize how much that balance of masculine and feminine energy it impacts and infiltrates every area of our being.
It's the framework for almost all the work that I do with my clients, whether they're male, female, somewhere, however they identify within the gender spectrum. My work is to help people deconstruct the concept that masculine and feminine is tied to a gender and to give people permission to freely express in the moment whatever energy fits or whatever they're called to show up in that moment, to find that, oh, this moment is looking for vulnerability and looking for care. I get to express my feminine energy, that more feminine energy in authentically in that moment. I don't have to hold it back. I get to fully be it. But then I also can be very goal-oriented and achievement-oriented in other parts of my life and other moments and lean more into that masculine. When we free ourselves up to play on the whole spectrum, there's so much more access to like showing up to meet the present moment as it is.
So much more access. I agree completely. I love that we kind of segued off into masculinity, and I love it. It's amazing. I'd like to kind of circle back and continue your conversation about shame, because I think that's such a heavy hitter. Not that masculinity is not, it is, but I'd love to dive a little bit deeper into the shame issue, if you're willing to go there.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, the reason the masculinity thing comes up is because it's where my shame exists. It's where I was coping with my shame the most in the world. Yes. So for me, they are very intrinsically tied. And yeah, happy to continue diving into the nuances of the shame.
You are right. They are intrinsically tied together. I've experienced exactly the same. So, yeah. Well, where do you go from here with that shame conversation?
Well, shame for me is, it's a powerful force. And I think so many of us are walking around carrying bits of it. And I think in the Brené Brown world, the researcher on shame and vulnerability, she would sort of differentiate shame and guilt from each other. That shame is the acknowledgement, or is the feeling that I am bad in some way. Whereas guilt is I have done something bad. There's a difference. Like guilt, you've done something and you can make amends for it. But shame is one of those like toxic things that really sits within us and keeps us feeling as if we're not enough, undeserving, unworthy, unwell in some way. And I work within that definition a lot. I think that that makes sense to me.
I agree. I'm a big Brené Brown fan, and I'm completely with you there. That definition I think is spot on. Once again, mic drop.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so I think I spend a lot of my own personal work is to continue recognizing where I'm telling myself that message, that I'm not enough, that I'm not worthy, that I'm unwell in some way, I'm undeserving in some way. And I think something that's been really healing is in my coaching work, in helping and supporting others, I get to also see how many others are carrying similar burdens with them. And I get together, we get to find our way through new avenues for how to release ourselves from that shame, to heal from that, to transform our relationship to that shame so that we are connected to ourselves, so that we belong to ourselves, so that we move through the world understanding our value and worth rather than spending so much energy trying to cope and trying to hide the fact that we don't feel enough in the world.
Yes. Do you see a distinction? Because there are similar energy. I sense that there is I don't have a language for the distinction, but I sense that there is a definite similarity from shame to embarrassment. What are your thoughts on that? Or what are your experiences on that, maybe?
Yeah. I think for me, embarrassment, I know Brené would have another definition of this, and it's not coming to my mind around how she clearly differentiates the two. But what comes up for me when I think about this is that embarrassment is a temporary acute experience.
Like a situational type thing.
Situational, yeah. And it happens in a moment and it can flood your system fully. But then your system can regulate and go back to a normalized sense of your status quo. Whereas shame is a bit more prolonged, a long-held belief system about self. And it even may not even be a conscious belief system. It may have gone so far into your subconscious that you just carry it around with you at all times. And it changes your perspective on when you view the world. It's sort of like you put a different lens on the camera and then now you're looking out the world through the lens and it's distorted in some way because you have a different lens on the world. Whereas embarrassment can be a bit more of like, ooh, that feels really vulnerable and I've just like been exposed in some way. And I think that, so I just think that there's a difference in sort of the triggers and the longevity of the experience of it.
Mm-hmm. I agree. I think you defined it really well. Thank you. I'm glad I asked that. I'd like to perhaps ask you if you could share something about the shame that you've experienced and the way you worked through it, but from an angle that allows the listener to feel it. Does that make sense? Does my question make sense?
Try asking another way.
Well, I think that we can, you know, talk about this from kind of a cerebral point, more factually, or we can get more on a feeling level. I'm wanting to see if we can get a little bit more on a feeling level, because I think the listener will get value out of, I mean, I think maybe everybody probably knows, you know, what the feeling of shame feels like. But yes, if as you share your own personal story, if you could tell it in a manner that we feel it.
Yeah. What comes to mind when I hear you say that is when I have a master's in social work, and I was working as an investigator for Child Protective Services for a few years in the Phoenix, Arizona area, right out of grad school. And so I was in a really tough job. It was my job to investigate abuse and neglect with children. I was seeing people in the worst points of their life, with many compounding issues like poverty and mental health issues and drug use and family histories of trauma. And so I had a job that was taking a lot from me and was very stressful as it was. But it's also the time frame just after my coming out process. I came out when I was 25-ish. And so I had a lot more work. Just because I came out does not mean that the work was done. Like, I had so much more personal work to do and self-reflection. My coming out process came, like, I delayed it. And then it just quickly accelerated out in a way that felt outside of my control. And so I didn't do all the prep work beforehand. I did it all after I came out. And so, I remember I was living in a small studio apartment, 308 square feet, I think, in the Phoenix area. And that little space first started out as a place of, independence. I'm on my own. I can afford this. This is my first like real job out of grad school. I'm not getting paid very much because social workers never get paid very much. And so I was asserting my independence. And yet that space became really suffocating. That small space where I isolated, where I disconnected, where I wasn't sure how to make my way through it. I had been, previous to my coming out, I had been in a relationship with a man for 7 years before I came out. We were best friends and roommates to everybody else, but we were both struggling with our sexualities. We were both really struggling to own who we were. We could do it with each other, but as soon as it meant anything about the outside world, we both locked up. We both became very afraid. We both became very unable to deal with and cope with what that meant to the outside world. Part of right around my coming out was also when that relationship ended. And so I was sitting there in grief. I was sitting there with a challenging job. And then I had all of this shame that wasn't really letting me come out into the world and actually start to experience myself as a gay man. So while I was telling people, I wasn't getting any of the fun benefits of being an out gay man, of being authentic out there in the world. And in some ways, I was doing a job that it felt really unsafe to own my sexuality as a social worker in CPS, not because of my colleagues, but because there is this thread of storyline that is told about gay men, that gay men are predators, that are sexually abused children, that they're deviants in some ways. And so I had no fear about myself, but I had this big fear that it just took one parent making up a lie about what I did with their child for my career to be ruined. And so I locked up my sexuality, and I had to come in as a force, as an investigator, because it was my job to investigate whether these kids were okay. And so I learned, like, there was a couple of years of really entrenching some coping strategies, some hardening up, some disconnecting from my vulnerability and my emotions as a way of staying safe and as a way of coping with the intensity of my life at that point. And I just remember being in that small studio apartment and feeling like it became a box of depression for a long time.
Well, and what you're describing too is I'm getting that you're going through your first serious relationship breakup, and because nobody knows and you're closeted, you don't even have anybody to confide in. So you had to go through that breakup solo. Mm-hmm. Ooh, rough.
I did have a few people that I could talk about it with, but my ex was very afraid of me talking about even myself, because it would out him. He wasn't ready for that. And so there were a lot of places that I was dealing with it alone. And I had a few outlets for it, but it's similar, like even within the context of our relationship, we only had each other to process what was going on. And so we got into some really codependent loops with each other, trying to like, I don't know how to navigate all the things I'm feeling and all the struggles that I'm having. And we can't do it with each other all the time because we're both scared little boys, and that's not helpful. And so there were a lot of places where I pulled in and was trying to deal with it all alone. I'm strong enough. I can deal with this all alone. And I clearly wasn't handling it very well, because I spent most of my 20s pretty depressed and pretty struggling and pretty disconnected, and without a sense of belonging, for sure.
Mm. Mission accomplished. I'm feeling it all. Mm. Yeah. Yeah. Wow. So what steps did you take to get past that?
Yeah, I mean, as I was saying, my coming out process came a little quicker than it appeared suddenly. And I was like, well, I guess I'm coming out now. But I was fighting it a little bit. One of the biggest things for me that transformed things for me was I was working as a behavior coach with kids during my time as an intern during my master's program. And I was working for an agency, and I was being given a client that was a 16-year-old boy who was trying to kill himself because he was gay and Mormon and couldn't reconcile his faith and who he was as a person. One could argue that is not a case that should be for behavior coaching, nor is it appropriate for an intern to be handling. So just want to say those right up front, that there were some inappropriate things being put on my plate. But I also wasn't out yet. And I had this huge ethical crisis, having just like been in my master's program and following my code of ethics as a social worker, where I recognized, like, I haven't even figured this out for myself. How am I going to help this kid? I haven't even been able to figure out how to be okay with myself. What do I have to even offer this young kid? And that was a big turning point for me. And it actually forced me to ask for help from a supervisor of mine through the university that I was going through, of like, I don't know how to navigate this. I don't feel safe to bring this to my internship, but I also can't take this case on because there is no way I can be of help or service to this kid. And so that I never even met that kid. And yet that kid changed my life because he showed me where I was out of my value system and where there was no moving forward until I addressed something. And so it made me ask for help, and it set me on a trajectory of actually doing the heavy lifting. There was a lot of years of crying. There was a lot of years of meeting with a mentor of mine that that supported me through this process, who became a de facto a second mother in my life, who could hold different parts of my coming out journey than my mom could. It really helped me find more pieces of myself. It's also what set me on the trajectory to becoming a coach, leaving the social work field and moving into being a coach a few years down the line.
No, I think what you're describing right now, and I've certainly experienced it myself, the heavy lifting and the years of crying, it's the road less traveled. And I think this is why so many gay men won't go there. Mm-hmm. I mean, I mean, that probably applies to the population at large, but that's not what this podcast is about. It's about gay men. And I think that we as a community generally tend to really shy away from this because we're frightened. We've already been beaten down as children, and now we're going to you know, walk down a pathway where we're going to go through, you know, well, there's a reason they call it the hero's journey. I've been on it for many, many years, and it's all over the map. It's up and down and all around and all over the map. And yes, it does get easier as you go, but there sure was a lot of really hard before it started to get easier. And yet I wouldn't trade for it for anything. Hmm. Like, I wouldn't trade for this journey for any, as hard as it has been. It's also been beautiful in so many ways. And there's no doubt in my mind that I now live a far more fulfilling, happy, joyful, contented life than I would had I not done the heavy lifting.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. When I decided that I no longer could run from this thing and had to just confront it, maybe not all gay men have to do the same level, or maybe not all gay men are open to doing the same kind of, like, confronting the darkness, confronting the sadness, the grief, the all of the repressed and unnavigated emotions along with it. But when I chose to confront it, it opened something up, and I had work to do. And my evolution has gone from, I was kind of resentful that I had to do all that work. I was kind of resentful that I was kind of pushed out of the closet. There were more elements that were playing out that kind of pushed me out. I look back on it now with gratitude. I'm like, well, thank goodness. I am such a risk-averse person that I will just keep trying to feather the nest before I ever have to actually take the leap of faith. And I think in some ways the universe knows that about me. And so it kind of gave me that little kick out of the nest that I needed. And I moved from a place of resentment around that to a place of, I'm so grateful, because as you're saying, my life is so much more fulfilling. I'm so much more on purpose. I belong to myself more. I have community of people that I belong with. And that doesn't mean that there aren't challenges along the way. And I think sometimes as coaches or therapists or people that are in the mental health and psychological fields, we can sort of either we project it out from ourselves, or people project it on us that our lives are perfect and that we don't have those struggles and we don't have our fears and our patterns don't come back up. For sure, mine still do, but it's a lot better than it was, and it's a lot more fulfilling. And there's no regrets now at this point on the choices that I made to actually start to claim myself and do that work, to claim my anger, to claim who I was in the world, to live more bravely in the world.
Yeah, I agree with you completely, Travis. You know, I liken it to that journey, that really, really tough journey. It's like the blacksmith takes the piece of steel and puts it in the fire and gets it red hot, and then pulls it out and puts it on the anvil and starts hammering on it. You know, that piece of steel goes through hell, and then at some point it emerges as this beautiful work of art, a sword that is just to perfection. And that's what the work is about. Yes, it was and still sometimes painful. And yet, I mean, I believe this is true of our biggest wounds. I look back on the biggest traumas that I experienced in my life, and I know beyond a shadow of a doubt, and I am grateful for those. I wouldn't want to relive those traumas, but I'm grateful because those experiences forged me into the man that I am today. And today I can sit here in front of you and tell you, I really, really love the man that I am today. Mm. Like I wouldn't be this guy if I hadn't been through all those painful experiences and through that journey and that road less traveled, and I hadn't been in the fire and on the anvil and under the hammer. There is a really, really good reason to do the work. Mm-hmm. And it's not, you know, it's doable. It's doable.
It's probably one of my biggest wants for our community as gay men is that more gay men get to have the experience that you just said, which is to maybe you don't hold it in every single moment of your life, but to have experiences of really, truly loving yourself. Not being impressed by yourself or being pleased with the body that you have or the sort of more external measurements of success, but to really sit with self and to love self. I think that's the biggest thing I want for our community. I think it's a huge part of our next developmental stage. I think in some ways, the bullying we've experienced, the rejection, the trauma of, like, in some ways, our community has gone through trauma many different times, but most importantly, like, thinking about, like, the 80s during the AIDS crisis, it's like we lost a whole generation of men.
My generation. So, yes. Yeah.
We lost a whole generation of elders, of people that have walked the path before us and can help guide us. And so we're doing the best we can all the time, but in some ways we've gotten stuck at a certain developmental stage. And I think there's another layer for us around having those moments of really loving ourselves, really loving the man that we sit within. That I think is what I most want for our community.
I agree with you completely. I firmly believe that self-love is literally the keys to the kingdom. That when you can firmly put that in place, and it's not black and white. It's not like you like go down to the grocery store and buy it and put it on the shelf and it's there forever. It's an everyday process. Self-love is not a place you get to. It's something that you do. You live it every day. But when self-love is in place, all of the rest of the life becomes sweet and falls into place. It's the key to everything.
Yeah, I can't think of one negative thing that comes from self-love.
Neither can I.
I don't find people that truly love themselves to be harmful people, to be engaging in some of these unsustainable patterns that we notice in the world. Yes, they're humans and they have their foibles and their flaws, but goodness comes from that self-love.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And yet you can't know that until you experience it. You know, we can tell you about it, but there is nothing like being alone with yourself, sitting with yourself, and just feeling this intense love for yourself. And that can look a lot of different ways. I mean, in times when I know that I need loving, I'm a single man. I live alone. And in times when I'm by myself and I know that I need some type of consoling, I will pile up in my bed and wrap my arms around myself just the way I would wrap my arms around a partner that needed to be consoled. And I talk to myself in the same manner that I would talk to that partner that I love that needed consoling. We absolutely have the ability to, we're all out there looking to get our needs met from someone else. And the truth is it's great to have that, but the way we're only going to really ever be able to enjoy it is if we're able to give it to ourselves first. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you mentioned that talking to yourself in a way that you would talk to a loved one that needed consoling. I think that's so much of the work for those of us, especially those of us who've integrated a significant amount of shame. If you actually pay attention to the way you talk to yourself and the way that you treat yourself when you're struggling, when you're feeling afraid, when you're feeling vulnerable, many of us have a pretty harsh voice.
Yes, and don't even realize it.
Totally. We think it's normal. Don't even realize it.
Yes.
It's just so a part of our normal that we don't even have any like awareness of it.
Well, and the truth is, if you talked like that to any friend that you have, you wouldn't have that friend.
Right. Yet we do it to ourselves.
To ourselves, yes.
I think that's where a lot of bang for the buck can happen when we start to put some awareness on the internal voice that we have with ourselves.
You're right. The key word is awareness.
Mm-hmm. And then we start giving ourselves permission to explore what would my voice be if I was talking to someone I deeply loved and cared about, and then utilizing that with yourself, bringing that inward, allowing yourself to experience that, I think there's a lot of bang for the buck in that.
I agree completely. So bringing it home, you know, you've taken us through the journey of the shame and the coping mechanisms and the ways that you begin to reintegrate with your authentic self. what is present in your life now that wouldn't be present? What are the things that you attribute very much to that process and that work you've done, those things that you wouldn't have if you hadn't taken that journey?
My relationships are the first things that come to mind. One of the things I'm most proud of is the relationship I have with my family of origin at this point. It hasn't always been an easy journey, but with my parents and with my brother, but we've all done a lot of really good work, and we've all done the work to see each other and to give each other the space we need. And I'm just so proud of who we are as a family. And I love celebrating all the work, because I don't know that everybody gets that experience. I don't know that a lot of gay men get that experience of the healing and the transformation that happens with their family of origin.
You know, I want to call out that what I heard you say that I want to really put emphasis on, when I ask you that question, you said relationships as in plural. And the first thing you went to was your family of origin, which is so not the norm, because we as gay men so often are so laser focused, tunnel vision on love and a partner and a relationship, a husband, however you want to word sex. That, sex, that yeah. we fail to see that there's a whole world of rich relationships out there that don't have anything to do with romantic love or sex. Mm-hmm. I mean, we focus on one thing and we lose many. Mm-hmm. And you did such a beautiful job of bringing some balance into it. You know, I'm assuming that somewhere in that mix you'd have gotten, if I didn't interject, you've gotten to your partner, because I know you have a husband. Y'all are married, correct?
We're not married, but we're just over 4 years out. And that would have been my next spot, is this relationship is so different than any relationship I've ever been in. I've spent so many relationships chasing men, trying to earn them, being with men that are sort of in and out of the relationship. And it's constantly like chasing them to continue proving that I am lovable and trying to get validation from people. And my current partner, we've been together over 4 years. I've never chased him once. He is present. He is there. He is willing. And that never would have come if I had not done the work on myself.
And what I'm hearing is it's specifically the self-love is what transformed all that. Mm-hmm. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah,
because I started that relationship from a place of being deeply aware of my needs and being willing to communicate them and recognizing, instead of shying away from them to get somebody to like me first and then trying to bring them in, I brought them in from the beginning and let him make a decision. Is this work for you or not? And gave him the freedom to say no. And he said yes. And he says yes over and over and over and over. And that to me has been a really powerful awareness of how many years I spent chasing a relationship, wanting that, putting all of my focus and my worth and value on whether the fact that I was single for so long. And when now that I'm in this relationship and feel as safe and secure in it as I do, I can recognize how much of my own work was important to get to this place.
Yes, absolutely. My tagline in my business is that we train people how to treat us. Mm-hmm. And your story is just a beautiful example of that. When you started embarking on the self-love and treating you better, that sent a signal, an energetic signal out to the whole world, and the whole world reflected back to you. The better you treated yourself, the better the world treated you. The more you cherished yourself and honored yourself, the more people showed up in your life that were also willing to honor and cherish you. And this is not hocus pocus mumbo jumbo. This is the real deal here. And you're clearly depicting that in your story. We train people how to treat us. And one of the ways we do that is by the way they see us treat ourselves. Mm-hmm. Now it's not a conscious thing. It's an unconscious thing. It's an energetic thing. There's three ways that we train people how to treat us, but that one is to me the big kahuna, because it's the one we're least aware of usually. Mm-hmm. We don't realize that, you know, we're bitching about how we're being mistreated, but we're not noticing that we're the ones that are mistreating ourselves. And the rest of the world's just following our example.
It's so true. An easy example of to see that is how often, like in a parent-child relationship, a parent will set a rule, but then they break their own rule. And the kid's very aware of that and can see that. We learn from other people's behaviors just as much, more so than what they tell us.
Yes.
And so if we are crossing our own value systems, our own belief systems, our own worth, then other people get to do that too, because they see it happening.
Yeah. Yeah. People are always going to model, either follow that's what's been modeled to them, not what's been told to them. Mm-hmm. You know, we've all heard about the parent who said, do what I say, not what I do. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Good luck with that.
Good luck.
Good luck with that.
Yeah.
Well, I have loved your stories. I've loved the gold, all the golden nuggets that you've shared. This has been absolutely amazing. Do you have any words of wisdom that you'd like to share with this listener before we wrap it up?
I think a piece of advice or an invitation that I have for other gay men who are on their own journey of becoming an authentic gay man is to lean into some curiosity of yourself, with yourself. Listen to yourself. Make some space and some time to really hear what's really going on for you, and to ask a lot of questions of yourself, rather than just taking your patterns and behaviors as just a given. Start asking why. Start asking, well, what does it mean to me if? What am I afraid of? Asking those questions to dive in a little bit deeper to your relationship to self. I think something that we've talked about in this conversation that is so vital and important is that belonging to self. It changes the world. It changes your perspective. It changes how you engage in the world. It changes how purposeful and fulfilled you feel in the world. It changes your relationships. And so being curious and learning to how to belong to yourself, which we weren't taught those skills. So it isn't something that you're going to necessarily know how to do right away.
It's foreign. Yeah.
And that's why people like coaches and therapists exist, because there's an outside person that can help you with that work. But that belonging to self is where you're going to get the most bang for your buck. And so get curious with yourself, listen. And if you need some support, ask for help. It's breaking the rules of being a man to ask for help. But I'd encourage you to break that rule.
Break that rule. Absolutely. And so I'm hearing somewhere in there, tell me if I'm wrong. You know, we hear people say, it's just the way I am. And if you're really, really getting curious and asking yourself those questions, that's just the way I am is a cop-out.
It's an easy answer.
Because it's an easy answer, yes. Because we get to be anybody we want to be. You get to show up in life any way you want to show up in life. And so I love what you're saying there about get curious and ask questions and challenge yourself. Is it, why is that the way I am? And do I want to be that way? Beautiful. I love your words of wisdom, Travis, very much.
Yeah, that phrase of it's just who I am or just the way I am, it ends the conversation. It puts a period at the end. Whereas asking more questions like, well, why is it the way I am? What does it mean? What is the benefit of me continuing this way? What would be the benefit of me trying on a different pattern? That keeps the conversation going and keeps the development process going for us as beings.
I love it. You know, yeah. Yeah. Another good couple of questions would be, what's the payoff of staying the same, and what's the mm-hmm. cost of staying the same? Mm-hmm. Beautiful, beautiful. Thank you so much. So let's move into our rapid fire questions. Are you ready for some rapid fire questions? Let
me buckle in.
For rapid fire answers. Mm-hmm. When was the last time you cried in front of another gay man?
2 days ago with my partner.
That was an easy answer, wasn't it? I love it. What is the one thing that you most wish that you could change about the gay male community?
I think it has to do with, in some ways, I see us often engaging in patterns that we learned from all of the ways that we were bullied and disempowered in the world. And so we are seeking to empower ourselves by taking power from other people or judging others or condemning others. And so it would be sort of to unlearn some of those ways that we were bullied and to stop bullying each other, stop rejecting and rewounding each other.
Oh, you took the words right out of my mouth, except for you said it a lot more eloquently than I probably would have. you articulate your thoughts exceptionally well. Everything that you've said today has been, if we didn't know any better, we would think it was all rehearsed. It was so beautifully stated. You're very articulate.
My parents have always said I started speaking at 9 months and didn't stop. So I've had lots of practice.
I love it.
Oh, and final question. At the end of your life, when you're about to take your last breath, what is the feeling that you most want to feel?
Belonging.
Oh, I love it. I love it. I was sitting here thinking, I haven't answered that question. And I think that would be my answer too. I don't know if I would have said that, but now that you said it, that would be my answer too.
I spent too much of my life not belonging that I'm just on that train that's the gig right there for me.
Man, I'll tell you what. And when you go from a lifetime of feeling like you don't belong and you experience a feeling of belonging, there isn't anything quite like it.
So true.
It is down to my very core. Mm-hmm. Travis, there's one thing I want to leave you with. First of all, I want to say thank you so much for coming onto the podcast and being an amazing guest. This has been great. I've enjoyed it thoroughly. I feel like I know you better. I feel like we're kindred spirits.
We went deep. You gotta be vulnerable, and that's how you get to know people.
We went deep, and I hope that the audience felt it because I did. I certainly did. So thank you for that. And the one thing that I want to leave you with is I want to tell you that you indeed, my friend, are an authentic gay man.
Mm, thank you. It's been a lot of work to get there, and I appreciate that.
And continues to be. I agree completely, but you're certainly well on the path.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. Thanks for allowing me to share my story and for getting curious about my story. Not everybody has the space to have somebody be that curious with them and to continue sharing their story. So I just appreciate you inviting me here and being able to just be fully myself here. So thank you.
It was completely my pleasure.